you were just 9 weeks pregnant when you realised something wasn't quite right and you experienced what I can only really imagine as really unsettling physical trembling coupled with anxiety and as a result check yourself into a mental health unit. That experience, yeah. It's already incredibly vulnerable. Can you talk me through how being pregnant impacted this and how you were treated when you did reach out for help?
Yeah, it was so hard for me to know because it was my very, very first pregnancy. So I didn't know if the trembling and the sleeplessness and the anxiety was because of my pregnancy or was going to hurt my pregnancy. So I kind of oscillated between stressing about both of those things. Mm. And it wasn't until gone a couple of weeks down the track that it was my cousin, who is a fashion designer, said to me, so not a doctor, I think you might be going through a withdrawal from your NDEP. And I'd been taking NDEP for a very long time because I'd had a very bad back. I'd had an accident when I was in my 20s. And no, my doctor didn't think to tell me that it was a mild antidepressant. When she put me on them, the doctor I found here in Melbourne when I became pregnant, and I looked for a doctor in my area who specialised in obstetrics. I wasn't happy with my clinic. I was like, nope, I want someone who deals with this. And it said she did on the website, and she didn't tell me that NDEP was a drug that I should come off slowly. Mm. And so in doing my own research, when I realised I was pregnant, I was like, oh, I can't be on this medication. I came off it. I told her the next day. She said that was totally fine. And it was a couple of weeks later that the trembling and the insomnia and the anxiety began. So it was a real failure on her behalf to know about it, you know.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing. I know a lot of this stuff it's traumatic.
I mean, I think the really good thing about having written it all down, first in an article and then in a book, is that it is upsetting and traumatic, and it was like the most horrible time in my life, hands down. Mm. But the more I talk about it, the more determined I am to kind of lay bare the experience so that other people don't go through it. I think that was really, you know, for me, the impetus of writing the book is like, well, if I, as someone, you know, with a PhD who lives in a middle-class suburb and, you know, has a very good grasp of the English language and, you know, if I can be subject and is a feminist, you know, and you know, has certain ideas about her own rights and her own body, if I could be subjected to this, then, you know, what must other people be through?
The book does go on to also illuminate the discrepancies and inequalities experienced by childbearing people and what is still considered women's work, i.e. child rearing. But women don't just pay physically for pregnancy, as you do outline. What other costs do they pay?
Well, there's a whole lot of, I think the way in which the kind of pregnancy machine now operates is it's just a massively anxiety-producing thing. And there's a number of reasons, I think, why. I mean, the proliferation of information via the internet, whether or not that is accurate or inaccurate information, doesn't help. But I think what we start to see in the 1970s with the kind of, you know, the widespread use of, you know, the invention of and widespread use of ultrasound technology is the emergence of the baby in utero. Mm. And I use the word baby quite deliberately because as soon as we start seeing it, it's not a fetus anymore, it's a baby. That's according to other people. Every pregnant person gets to decide for themselves what that means. But as soon as that imaging becomes available as a culture, a different patient emerges for the doctor, and a far more interesting patient, you know, because it's really novel and that technology is only like 50 years old. So there's this Ricky Solinger, who's an American historian, she talks about the fact that it's a zero-sum game. So when the person performing the ultrasound on the pregnant person is looking at the pregnant person, they're looking at you. And when they're looking at the baby, they're looking at the baby, and you can't look at both at the same time. You know, the image of the baby is on a screen somewhere and then the pregnant person is in front of them. And so what we see happens in the 70s is this idea that because we can see the baby in utero, we can fix any issues that happen with the baby. We can prevent miscarriage. And this is all not true. There are very few medical interventions that can be made on a fetus. And if a fetus is not going to survive the pregnancy, then there's very little that can be done to stop that. So I think women are now given this extra stress that didn't exist before, which is like, well, because we can see the fetus and we can fix the fetus, it's also you have more responsibility to look after the fetus. And if something happens, it's your fault. So it's a massive stressor that is really new in our culture. You know, 100 years ago, people had 8 or 10 kids because they realized that not all of them were going to survive pregnancy or into adulthood. And now, because we're delaying when we have children, there's the idea that every child should be a wanted child and every child, every fetus should come out of pregnancy perfect and whole, and somehow if it doesn't, it's the woman's fault.
It's that idea of treating the pregnant person as the vessel as opposed to a human being going through this incredibly, inherently traumatic experience. Do we know much about, you know, the long-term impacts of this thinking and what it can do to a pregnant person and what the ramifications are?
Well, we are seeing a spike in anxiety in pregnant people. We're seeing more, and people who experience anxiety during pregnancy are far more likely to experience it postnatally as well. So we're seeing a lot more anxiety in pregnant people and in their spouses. And there's been researchers here in Australia which have found that children born to parents who have postnatal depression are also, within the first 4 years of their life, going to have issues around emotional regulation, I think, and education. And so there are, you know, potentially huge ramifications in creating this much stress.
How do you take care of yourself when you are pregnant and dealing with these dialogues from doctors, from other people? And how did you take care of yourself whilst writing about this experience?
Well, it was real. I don't think I took care of myself very well in the first pregnancy. And I think that had a lot to do with, you know, what was happening to me medically and in terms of coming off the drug so quickly. I am lucky in that I can afford to, you know, pay to see a psychologist or a psychiatrist. I was also lucky in that I had, you know, good employment with leave provisions so that on days that I felt very, very sick, I could take a day of leave or a week of leave because I had the hyperemesis gravidarum as well, so I was vomiting all the time. I was very lucky to have a female employer who was incredibly sympathetic. And so I was lucky to be able to put those things, some supports in place in terms of seeing a perinatal psychiatrist, seeing a perinatal psychologist, finding a really good doctor through my friend, having the kind of work where I could take leave if I really needed to, and, you know, resting when I needed to. But it's pretty miserable being sick, so it was always a fine line between resting and also having my mind occupied enough so I wasn't thinking only about how sick I was. So, I mean, I think a lot of it is having a community of people around you. And you know, I had amazing friends who, if I couldn't cope in a day, I could just go to my friend Miriam's house, and she was on maternity leave, and I could go and sit on her sofa and cry or watch terrible TV with her, or, you know, and just have that comfort. So it's really about, you know, getting your networks into place. And before I had my second child, I made sure that I had my networks in place so that you know, my employers knew a little bit about my history. And again, I'm lucky to work in a job where they're very sympathetic to that. I mean, I think everyone should be lucky enough to work in a job where they're sympathetic.
Agreed.
Good leave and good care and all of those things.
Yeah, it's great to hear you did have that support, as you do touch on in the book as well. Not everyone has that. And we don't even necessarily have those structural supports in place, i.e. maternity leave that is good enough to support a family that is has recently had a baby or welcomed a baby into their family. A lot of the costs and stuff, they're not surprising. We know that women's work is often devalued and devalued every day in the workplace. Was there anything though that surprised you in terms of the costs of labour that come out in the book and your research?
Yes, one thing, and this is definitely a day that I emailed my friends and said, you're not going to believe this. One thing that really got to me was the statistic that working women today, and I'm sure men, but there's not enough research, as I say in the book, done on how men parent, but working women today, regardless of if they work part-time or one job or three, spend more one-on-one time with their children than stay-at-home parents, women in the 60s and 70s. Like, that just blew my mind. That's not an accident. That's not, like, a weird coincidence. You know, because in the 60s and 70s, what you see is women becoming comfortable in the jobs that they've had post-World War II. You know, post-World War II is the first time in which women enter traditionally masculine fields in a very concentrated way, and then they don't leave. It's the first time that you see women start to have authority over men, because if you think about women's paid work beforehand, it was governesses who reported to the head of a household, or women who worked in factories and then reported to usually a woman foreman and then a male manager, or women who worked in schools and reported to a headmistress. So it's the first time we start to see women having kind of any kind of cultural authority over men. And so then at the same time in the 60s, you start hearing stuff about attachment theory and how important it is for babies to see their mothers, not their fathers, apparently that's not important.
Yeah, don't need them.
My husband would beg to disagree, and so would my children.
But just, you know, those traditional roles do come into play, and there is sectionality that does come into play when you are pregnant, particularly if you are from a First Nations background or a Cowd background. And I did find those insights really illuminating. Can you talk us through some of those differences between, say, non-Indigenous people and Indigenous people in particular?
For sure. I mean, when we talk about, you know, the kind of colonisation of Australia, then there becomes a project in which we're really interested in, the birth of the Australian nation, as is seen by the British people who have, you know, seized control by terrible, terrible means. And so what the culture wants at that time is the birth of more white babies. And so the babies that are there's so much mental gymnastics that go into it. It's quite unbelievable. But, you know, white babies are wanted and revered, and brown babies are absolutely not, because, you know, at the time and for the last 200 years, you know, a big part of the colonising project in Australia has been to diminish the population rate of Indigenous people and to increase the population rate of white European people. So people from the European mainland, predominantly from places like England. That's the goal in Australia, is English. And so you also at that time see, you know, the idealization of the European mother, the white mother, and a subsequent demonization of the brown mother. So the white mother should have children and should have more children, and the brown mothers, whether they're Indigenous or Muslim or, you know, come from countries in Africa, they have too many children as far as, you know, mainstream Australia is concerned.
Thank you so much, Natalie. Look, as someone who is predisposed to poor mental health, this topic is something that I have often thought about. And so your book kind of consolidated all of my thoughts and my worries, and it taught me a lot. So thank you so much.
Well, it's okay. And I think, you know, one of the things I think is that forewarned is forearmed. Someone said to me, do you expect people to have babies after reading this? Like, yeah, if I could have another baby after my terrible experience, I am not special. Other people can have babies. We just have to kind of go into it with our eyes open and able to advocate for ourselves and surrounded by people who will also advocate for us. So I don't think anything should rob us of the joy of parenthood if that's what we want. But we should go into it with eyes open and ready to speak up for ourselves. So I hope if you do have kids, you are able to do that for yourself.